This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Monster Hunter Memoirs, Saints, written by Larry Correa and John Ringo, performed by Oliver Wyman.
Prologue. You know that feeling when the worst is over? When you realize you might just live through this? For anyone who's reading this who isn't a hunter, and how the hell did you get your hands on this book? Say you've just been in a car wreck. Everything stops crashing, and you realize you're still alive. Uninjured, even. Relief floods your body like a physical force. That was what we were feeling. Right before a slime and tentacle-covered Rottweiler literally came through the fucking wall and tore into one of the drillers. It kept shaking the guy even though he dropped stone dead as soon as it bit him. I just opened up the spout on the fire hose and hit that Rottweiler bastard with a full-power blast of holy water. It began rolling around and shrieking.
"We're surrounded," Sam Haven said from behind me.
"Cut the water!" Milo yelled to Boss Shackelford as slime ghouls started piling through the nearest hole. "I need to go flame on!" "Fuck this!" I shut off the valve and dropped the hose. "Flame on! Go hot!" I lifted my .203 and launched a grenade. The round hit a ghoul in the head and the explosion shredded the undead around him. But it wasn't stopping the tide. The dark god's tentacles picked them up like puppets on strings and put them right back in the fight. I realized I was surrounded by a nimbus of light. Looking over my shoulder, I saw that Father Ferguson had his cross raised above his head. The undead were quailing back from it, but they were still being driven forward. The old one did not care about their pain.
"That's got them stalled," the boss said. "Let's rest in peace, these sons of bitches."
I just ignored the M16 part of the .203 and started laying waste with the grenade launcher. Sam was right next to me, hitting the masses of undead as fast as he could reload. Then the lights started to fail. I looked over my shoulder, and Father Ferguson was sweating like a pig. "Father?"
"It's fighting me. It's pushing back against the power of God. And it is quite powerful."
I recalled the fragmentary scroll I'd discovered, which had eventually led us to the truth about this monster. Even the power of Buddha was insufficient against the monster of the deeps. While Father Ferguson had a lot of faith, he wasn't more powerful than an old one. Even a larval one.
"We've got to hold this rig till it's dead."
All I knew at that point was we had to keep killing as long as it took. As long as we lasted.
"We can't give another inch."
The undead were pressing forward, a solid wall of red eyes and grasping hands. When they got under the range, we could fire grenades, so we switched to kinetic, but 556 barely pisses off whites. The vamps had their fangs out. I looked down, and there was a fucking Siamese cat with enormously long incisors. It looked like a baby saber-toothed tiger. I think it might have been a fucking cat vampire. A vampire cat. Was that even possible? That was just too wrong to begin to describe. It was even sort of cool-looking. It was just at the edge of arming range for the .203, so I blew it away with a 40-millimeter grenade. They were getting down to hand-to-hand range, and I drew my sword from the sheath. Maybe this was the battle for which the Lord had returned me to this vale of tears. At least it would be a battle to tell St. Pete about. As the undead closed in, I started servicing hands and arms first. Keep them from grabbing me, keep them from grabbing the Padre. Whenever I could, I slashed through the slimy cords tethered to their backs. Once severed from the old one, the undead were quickly destroyed by the wardstone. But there were just too damned many of them.
"We're about to be overrun,"
Boss Shackelford said, pulling out a grenade.
"Seems like now's a good time to see the other side."
As he said that, there was a sound like thunder. A low, deep rumbling, followed by the blast of a horn. It wasn't your normal horn. It was a terrifying sound that struck right into the bowels and said, "This is evil."
Run.
A massive gate opened in the floor of the warehouse, and with a crackle of Fey energy, a wild hunt erupted in all its eldritch horror. How bad of a day are you having when a wild hunt showing up is a good thing? You might be wondering how I got myself into this predicament. I blame, well, myself, fully. This was unquestionably, entirely my fault. My name is Oliver Chadwick Gardenier. Call me Chad. This is my job. I'm a monster hunter. Note. This is the last of the three memoirs Albert found in the archives. They'd been in the section damaged during the Christmas party incident of 1995, and lost ever since. I hadn't even known these things existed until Al brought them to me. Heck, I was surprised Chad had ever written anything other than stuffy academic papers for Oxford or strongly worded letters to congressmen. What you are holding in your hands is the complete manuscript, the version we'll eventually put in the library that any regular newbie could just wander in and read, is going to have a few bits redacted for obvious reasons, like secret identities or any parts where the company might have kind of, sort of, accidentally broken the law and worked with puff-applicable entities, that sort of thing. Chad wrote these so that future hunters could learn from those who came before. Except, obviously, he couldn't tell the story to the end. I started writing an afterword myself, but I just couldn't do it. It brought back too many memories, and I ended up standing in front of the memorial wall for a long time, reading names. I'm going to show these memoirs to Earl Harbinger. He and Chad didn't always get along, but I think he needs to be the one to finish the story. People need to know how it ended. Iron Hand deserves that. Milo Ivan Anderson, Monster Hunter International, Cazador, Alabama. Book 1. Embrace the Suck. Chapter 1. In Primus, I quit. Ray the Third had called. Happy Face was inbound. It was 2 days after Mardi Gras, and I was finally going to get some reinforcements. I told them I'd be in the office, and the door was open. I was in Trevor's office behind the desk, pushing all the paperwork involved in a Class 4 event, when Earl walked in with a really closed expression. Sometimes you gotta do another contract even when you know the shit was probably gonna hit the fan, right? MCB's special response team was in town. How bad could it be? I was the only survivor of Team Hoodoo. Every other member had died on Fat Tuesday, along with all the regular field agents of MCB New Orleans, and most of the Sheriff's Special Investigations Unit. That's how bad. Team Happy Face, Earl's team, heavy hitters for Monster Hunter International, the MHI Elite, our designated SWAT, had been chasing down a pishtaco in Peru while the rest of my team had their skulls cracked and their brains sucked out. When New Orleans was already out of control and it was Mardi Gras, they'd taken a contract out of the country and left us hanging. Earl should have known. He should have been there. I told Agent Myers regarding the incident that caused him to leave MHI. Sometimes shit happens in this business. Get over it. Those words burned now. Shit had happened. Generally, I got over it. I'd blown my best friend's head off to save him a long, lingering death. New Orleans had seen a bunch of hunters come and go, most of them dead. I was at the point of not bothering to learn their names. But Fat Tuesday had been a bit much. I was done. With some help, a lot of help, really, I'd handled all the arrangements. Remy, my gentleman's gentleman, had handled shipping the urns of the recently deceased to their families, those that had them. Trevor's and Fred's were sitting up on a shelf in the team shack. Madam Courtney had arranged the funeral procession. Most of the time I'd been writing reports and filling out puff paperwork. Then there was the government. The Monster Control Bureau agents I'd worked with for a year were dead. We'd fought together, worked together, partied together in a way that was unique for both MHI and MCB. I understood why they did what they did. I didn't like it. They didn't like it. Nobody liked it. It was brutal and awful, and it was necessary. New Orleans was the test case for when the first reason no longer worked. I'd had one meeting with the incoming MCB replacements. That hadn't gone well. I'd had to go back to the site of the incident. Most of the bodies had been cleared up, thanks to the efforts of the Louisiana National Guard, but we were still finding the fluorescent mantis shrimp when they started to smell. Most of the waterfront in the French Quarter was closed off. Tourists were still in town and trying to find out what was happening. I was talking to a National Guard lieutenant, thanking him for ensuring Shelby's gear got returned, when Captain Rivette walked up with a couple of MCB agents. Rivette was the head of the NOLA Sheriff's Special Investigations Unit, SIU. Heavyset, balding, blonde hair, 50s, watery blue eyes. He spent as much time in his office as possible and never personally got anywhere near Hoodoo if he could avoid it.
Iron Hand, this is Special Agent Philip Campbell and Agent Jack Robinson from MCB. Special Agent Campbell, Agent Oliver Chadwick Gardenier.
Call me Chad, I said, holding out my hand. It was covered in some shrimp goo. Mr. Gardenier, Campbell was medium height, black hair, sharp eyes, real quick. He looked at the hand, then back up, but didn't extend his. Quite a mess you made here. This is going to be hell to cover up. Okay. I dropped my hand. You want to play it that way? That's fine. We kept a Class 4 from turning into a Class 5 when it hit the parade live on national television. But if you want to blame the heroes instead of, you know, whoever raised these things, you can feel free. Dealt with that sort of shit from MCB most of my career. Also seen your kind come and go from New Orleans when you fucking crack. I am not going to crack, as you say, Campbell snarled. I also am not going to allow the sort of unprofessional behavior that Castro considered normal. Be clear on that. We are going to shut down supernatural outbreaks in this town. New Orleans is going to be brought to heel. And so are you. Good luck on that, I said, nodding. Be glad to see it. The town brought to heel. Especially given that I've already had to bury a bunch of my people and still have more to take care of. Cutting down on our casualty rate would be nice. Like to know how you're going to do that in this town, but if you do, more power to you. For one thing, no more out-of-control response. No more use of explosives when something less obvious can do. And no, let me repeat that, no use of light anti-tank weapons. I cannot believe you weren't charged for that in the first place. Yeah, I shook my head. Not gonna listen to you on that one. Especially given how many we've lost, even with out-of-control response. And before you bow up and explain all the hell and damnation you can bring down on my head, be aware that I'm better friends with the people who pay your salary than you are. And if it takes taking a trip to D.C. to explain why you have to use a law on something two stories tall that regenerates, I'll take that trip. Or a Barrett on a giant regenerating super frog. Or C4, or claymores, 'cause I'm tired of burying people, you useless fuck. That initial exchange would determine the future course of my working relationship with Special Agent Campbell. It didn't go well.
You use language like that with me again, and I'll have you charged.
Then fucking charge me, Boy Scout. I walked away. This is your problem. Not mine. So that's why when Earl Harbinger walked in, I just stood up and waved at the desk. "All yours," I said. "I quit."
"Chad."
Ray Shackelford had followed Earl into the office. "Don't." I walked around the desk and to the door. Ray was blocking it. "If you don't mind..."
"Let him go," Earl said. "It's okay." "Where you going?" "We're gonna have to send you the check."
"I've still got the house. Send it there. Now, if you'll excuse me..." As I walked by the team room, Milo was there. Milo Anderson was one of my best friends. Probably my best living friend.
"Chad?"
Milo looked pained. "Nice knowing you, Milo." I walked out. Remy had already made the arrangements. I had 2 weeks scheduled at a Sandals resort in Jamaica. I'd asked Points, Cheryl Collins, if she wanted to go. I knew it was a mistake. She'd take it as a sign I wanted to expand and improve on the relationship. I didn't really care. I have a really firm belief, reinforced by Ash Wednesday when I'd cremated all my brothers and sisters in arms, that nobody in this business should have close attachments. No kids, no spouses, not even serious relationships. I was to the point of not even wanting to have friends, because about the time I got to liking somebody, they up and died. Plenty of people disagreed. Susan Shackelford, Ray the Fourth's wife, was not only beautiful, but a fairly serious breeder, with 3 kids so far. The fact that a little later on she died in her 30s, still beautiful and leaving behind those 3 kids and her grieving husband, sort of makes my case. I'd met Points, so-called for Points All Her Own, sitting way up high, not long after I'd gotten to New Orleans. She was a waitress and aerobics instructor by actual profession, but professional cheerleader by avocation. Brunette, slender, brown eyes, great legs, and very nice chest. Incredible ass. We'd been an off-again, on-again thing ever since. But I'd always been real clear about not having any serious relationship. And when she hadn't believed me, I'd slept with her best friend to make the point. Was that a nice thing to do? No. Was it better than leaving behind a grieving widow and orphans? Yes, in my opinion. So I'd always kept it light. I was good in bed. She generally had a good time. I was even up for the occasional shoulder to cry on, and the one time she'd gotten into a really bad relationship with a seriously fucked up stalker, I'd convinced him he needed to find someone else to stalk. Dangling upside down in a tree with a bunch of shamblers under you all night will do that. But she was going to see going away for 2 weeks as an upgrade in the relationship. I knew that. What I wasn't sure at that point was if it was or not. Because I really had quit. And if I wasn't a monster hunter anymore, things like real relationships were a possibility. 2 weeks at Sandals sort of cured me of a lot of illusions. First of all, any idea how boring a place like that is? There are any number of fun activities at a Sandals resort. Just ask their promoters. 1, sit on a beach getting sun. Ever woken up on a beach sunburned, screaming about giant spiders? People look at you funny. 2, go swimming. Ever fought a Luska? I hadn't, but I'd heard about them. Every time I looked at the water, I wanted to have my guns with me. People look at you funny when you go swimming with an Uzi on your back. Not that I had my Uzi. I didn't have any weapons except a little pocket knife. It was terrifying. For 3 years, I'd been heavily armed at all times. The time I killed a loop guru while out jogging had convinced me that the real reason for the Second Amendment was the Founding Fathers knew damned well there was supernatural and wanted their citizenry prepared. I'm surprised it didn't read, "For the purposes of a well-regulated militia, the right to keep and bear arms especially loaded with silver, shall not be infringed. 3. Go shopping. Cheryl certainly loved that aspect. I was so full of puff money, I could probably support her shopping habits for some time, but not indefinitely. 4. Party all night long. There was dancing, calypso bands, let your hair down. That I sort of got into. Drink enough, you can sort of forget black shadows in a cemetery tearing you apart while zombies closed in, or fluorescent mantis shrimp flying through the air to crack your skull open, spiders bigger than a mammoth, but they always came back when you were dealing with the hangover. 5. Screwing. They don't specifically mention that in the brochure, but it's implied. Did a lot of that. But no matter how hard I screwed, I could not get the image of fluorescent shrimp pouring up the side of a bell tower to take out Shelby. 6. Talking. Again, not specifically mentioned in the brochure. It was, however, the last point that made it clear Points and I weren't suited for anything longer than, say, a few hours now and again. We had exactly nothing to talk about. Look, I am, God help me, an intellectual. I may have hated that fact growing up and fought against it, but it is nonetheless true. I have a doctorate from Oxford in linguistics. I wrote the first definitive work on North American Yeti, Sasquatch, Bigfoot. I wrote the dictionary and linguistics text on their language. I wrote the dictionary and linguistics text on North American Knoll, as well as an analysis of their social structure here versus that of Europe and England. Ditto Swamp Ape, Florida and Louisiana tribes, and Laurentian Yeti. I do third-order polynomials in my head. Assuming I was going to quit and get a real job, what is a real job, and settle down behind a white picket fence, it would have to be with someone I could carry on an adult conversation. That wasn't Points. There were other guys there. From time to time, we'd all cluster up to get away from our airhead girlfriends, fiancés, wives, some of them were on honeymoons, to have guy conversations. I can talk about football. It's not my favorite topic, but I sort of keep up when I can. Hell, I've got 50-yard line season tickets for every Saints game. Not that I use them personally. Who had time? I traded them for favors. I can talk about stocks and bonds. Commodities is something of a specialty when I have the time to focus. I can talk about portfolios. I have one and keep up with it. I can definitely talk about girls and screwing the couple of times we went out deep-sea fishing. I've got a million stories along those lines, though I had to sort of dance around the subject of trailer park elf girls. I can play poker. Hell, I could be a professional poker player. It's a matter of being able to do the odds in your head and knowing when to fold. The problem I kept running into was, let me do this properly.
Hey, Tom, Keith said. This is Chad.
Keith Brown was one of those guys that instantly knows everyone and does all the introductions. He worked in corporate relations, which he'd had to explain to me. Basically, it was schmoozing bigwigs from other corporations to smooth out deals. Corporation A, his, wants to get Corporation B to go in on buying a big piece of property. Could be another company, could be real estate, whatever. Keith's job was to know everything possible about the likes and dislikes of Corporation B's movers and shakers and make sure they had a good time while the negotiations were going on. Something like that. He could simply not get out of mode at Sandals. So he instantly introduced himself and in 3 minutes knew everything about you. Well, except me. I was sort of an enigma on some stuff. Tom, I said, shaking Tom's hand.
Tom's a broker with Morgan Stanley in the city. Chad is a former Marine and...
Keith paused and frowned. I do classified security work, as in violent security, not securities. Mostly associated with federal and local governments, some corporate. I've got a hooking scar on the left side of my face, courtesy of a loop guru. My nose has a cut through it, right on the bone, from a shotgun pellet. The side of my neck is stitched like Frankenstein from another pellet that's still lodged against my esophagus. You wear shorts and short-sleeved shirts at Sandals. Mine was a Team Hoodoo polo. I'd had to have it made. They weren't issue. Embroidered MHI on the chest with a shrunken head, so all the scars on my arms and legs were exposed. Between the bombing and my job, I'm a baby-faced, blonde, short, muscular Frankenstein.
Looks like you've seen a lot of action, Tom said, shaking my hand back.
He was a pretty big guy. Iron pumper. Crusher grip. I crushed back harder. He winced. I had much the smaller hands, and they sort of looked fine. They're not. He probably should have noticed the Popeye forearms. Beirut bombing, among others, I said, finally letting him go. At which point we would talk about Tom's job, because classified. Or I'm pigging out on shrimp.
You really seem to like the shrimp, Chad,
Keith would say. Just trying to get the little bastards back, I said, popping another one in my face. Yeah, only Points got that, and she sort of flinched. She knew outside of New Orleans you didn't talk about hoodoo. She hadn't been there, thank God. She'd been uptown, partying with some linemen from the New Orleans Saints. But she knew what had happened. It wasn't like you could keep a secret in New Orleans. Do I pick up a finance degree, put on a suit, and go get a job in the city? I'm one of those guys who with a couple weeks' study could pass any bar you'd care to name. I got boku contacts. I could get any job I'd want to do. Be a Monster Hunter lobbyist in D.C. and run with the big dogs? I missed killing monsters. There is a feeling you get. There are no words to express the real meaning of victory. English lacks the verbs and adjectives for the emotions. There is no cool deal, no great win in court, no power play that would ever equal standing on the carcass of some powerful dead thing you just defeated. What are the joys of a man? A strong sword in the hand? Check. A field of victory? Check. To see the bodies of his enemies slain. Oh, yeah. I was ragingly pissed off at MHI. I felt like they'd left us to hang. But it was like I told Myers when he was getting all Billy Bad Cop. Shit happens in this business. Getting pissy because something went wrong meant you needed to go find another line of work. Go live behind a picket fence and think that will protect you from the things that go bump in the night. There's a saying. Don't remember who said it. I have loved the stars too fondly to ever fear the night. I have loved the night too fondly to ever fear the stars. And the night I loved the most fondly was the night where bad things were creeping through it, and I was the thin line between light and darkness, between life and death, where I was the baddest motherfucker in that dark valley. I was a monster hunter. I was a stone killer who missed the rush like a heroin addict misses horse. Once an addict, always an addict. I could get a job in the city. I could pretend it wasn't real, but I would always be an addict. It was all I would ever be, could ever be. Maybe someday I'd retire. Maybe. Someday I'd find some young thing who wasn't a steel-bellied airhead and settle down. Buy a castle, stock it with heavy weapons, and raise some seriously fucked-up kids who were just as stone killers and would probably rebel by becoming monster advocates. Someday. But not today. Remy met us at the airport. I dropped points at her apartment with the promise that I'd call her, which I did, a couple of weeks later. Then I had Remy drive to the office. "Hey, Milo," I said, walking past the team room again.
"Chad?"
Milo said, getting up. He was in armor and on call. I just waved and walked to the office. Earl was in there, smoking like a chimney, clearly furious about the paperwork. I refused to be the team lead, I said without preamble.
"Got it." Earl didn't really show any reaction. "Franklin's already taken over as team lead, so no problem. Milo, leave us alone. And close the door. Sit down, Hand.
I'm just a hunter. All I'm ever gonna be."
"I wasn't gonna ask you to be team lead anyway. Shut up and sit down."
Earl opened a drawer and pulled out a bottle. He poured some for me into a coffee cup and shoved it toward me.
"Drink and listen."
I'd drink. Don't know if I'd listen.
"I'm gonna say this once. I know you're mad. You feel abandoned. Only we all thought things were getting back to normal, or as normal as this town can get. You had a full team, and the Fed's best elite strike force camped next door. Yes, if I'd known what would happen, I would have been here. Only I got a few hundred other hunters scattered across the world to worry about. And sorry, I ain't got a magic crystal ball predicting the future to tell me which ones are in the most danger. You want to hold a grudge? Fine. Just don't let it get in the way of your job. So either get over it, or get the fuck out."
"Fine.
When can you be back on?"
"Tomorrow," I said. "I've got to get my gear back in operation."
"See you tomorrow at 9, Earl said, nodding.
"Just in time for the full moon. When are you leaving?"
"I'll be in town, but unavailable."
"I still say we put a radio trank collar on you and it would work. Let you out of your cage to handle shambler hordes. Trank you when you're done. Reload it. Put you back in the cage. Lather, rinse, repeat."
"Because I know why you're pissed." "I'll let you say that once," Earl said.
"You don't realize how serious I am. I already made the collar."
Chapter 2. I was back on duty. Same team room, different team. I was just getting to know most of them. A couple of faces were familiar. Franklin Moore had been on the MHI team that responded to a zombie outbreak in Elkins, West Virginia, only to find it had been cleared by a recently discharged Marine named, well, me. 5'8", brawny, black, and unflappable. That covered Franklin. He'd taken over as head of Team Hoodoo and kept the name. David King, a.k.a. DK, had helped me out about a year before with some vampires. He'd joined MHI after he finished recovering from a torn-up forearm, gone through training, and spent the next 6 months working with our New York team. He wasn't a New Orleans native, but knew the town from a couple of years working as security in clubs, mostly goth or punk. 6'4", blonde, but shaved scalp, which was normal in Team Hoodoo. Solidly built. The Happy Face team would remain in town to backfill us until Team Hoodoo was back up to speed. Supposedly, unless Earl felt like screwing me over again on a whim. Most of them I knew, especially Ray the Fourth and Milo. As I walked in and sat down, Milo waved.
"Chad, Earl said you'd be back. Glad to see he was right."
"Glad he's such a fucking clairvoyant," I said. Milo looked hurt. Earl had saved his life and avenged his family. Earl was like a dad to him. Milo was just too damn nice for his own good. Hurting Milo's feelings always felt like kicking puppies.
"I'm back. That's all there is to it. Shit happened.
Time to get my game face on.
So, Ray said, subject change. Susan wanted me to say thanks for Julie's birthday gift, Chad.
He didn't sound like he actually meant thanks. Sounded more like Susan had said other words.
Did Julie like it?
I perked up. The Shackelford kids were adorable.
Right up until we had to explain it was going to have to go to a nice farm upstate to live with all the other baby kaiju.
Why? I asked. Those things take like 100 years to grow to any size. What's a kaiju?
Norbert Leclerc asked.
Norbert was another recruit from New Orleans. About a year before, we'd started to recruit through the New Orleans Truth Teller,
the paper the MCB published that covered local hoodoo. The MCB worked very hard to cover up the existence of the supernatural. In the case of the Truth Teller, it was a matter of lying by telling the truth badly. The Truth Teller was full of misspellings, bad grammar, and things that had clearly never happened. It looked like it was published by a psycho. But embedded in it were many true stories of supernatural outbreaks. That way, if some true story filtered out of New Orleans, somebody else could disprove it by pointing to the Truth Teller. I'd heard already that the new breed of MCB in New Orleans had put a stop to it. But a year or so ago, we'd used it to do a full-scale recruiting drive. Leclerc was one of the returnees from that campaign. Young, black, skinny, but more muscular wiry than when I'd first met him. He was functionally illiterate and as purely street as you were going to get. But he'd done pretty well for 6 months on my old team in Seattle and, again, knew the town, so that was a bonus.
Godzilla, Decay said. Baby Godzilla. Did you know the juveniles climb trees? Ray said.
Duh. It keeps them away from the cannibal adolescents.
Have you ever tried to get a baby kaiju out of a live oak? Ray asked.
No.
Was it funny?
Did you get a home movie?
Oh, yeah, it was funny as heck, Milo said, grinning. We've got about 2 hours of video of Ray cussing up a storm trying to catch that thing. They're fast.
And they start breathing fire really young, Ray added, holding up his arm. Which is where the fresh burn scars come from. Oh, and Susan wanted me to add that you owe us a new refrigerator.
Why refrigerator?
It figured out where they were keeping the fish, Milo said, howling. And it burned a little circular hole in the bottom of the door, climbed right in and ate everything in the fridge.
I'll cut you a check.
Where'd you score a baby kaiju? Decay asked.
I've got friends in low places. And I didn't score a baby kaiju. I scored a kaiju egg and painted it up to look like an Easter egg.
We've learned to carefully examine all of Chad's gifts, Ray said darkly. He got that one by us.
Ray and Susan's kids say Uncle Chad always gets them the best gifts, Milo giggled. Like those flashbangs you gave Nate.
You gave a kid a flashbang? John Glenn said.
John Glenn was another truth-teller returnee. Heavy-set, bearded, and still wearing that stupid beret. At least he'd gotten rid of the SAS badge. Seriously obnoxious, obsessive, libertarian, paranoid schizo. His abilities were proven in earning nearly $300,000 in Puff money before he even found out about Puff. I'd put up with the constant diatribes about the evils of government, special interests, and iron triangles for the headbanger hoodoo killer mentality. He still was annoying.
No, I said innocently. Julie had mentioned that what Nate really needed for Christmas was a lump of coal.
So I sent him some. Which turned out to be, essentially, very powerful fireworks disguised as lumps of coal, Ray said dryly.
I did warn you on that one. Nate's little. I didn't want him to get hurt.
You mentioned that for coal it was, and I quote, a little
energetic, Ray said. You didn't say it fucking explodes with tremendously loud bangs.
That is the chemical definition of energetic. You should have remembered my sole high school A was in chemistry.
Which was, to be clear, one hell of a surprise, Ray said. Especially in our fireplace.
That was the point, I said.
That's evil, Decay said.
I like it. I will never have kids of my own, and the only nieces and nephews I might ever have are from my brother, who I avoid like the plague. And assuming he ever spawns, they will be, let me make this clear, spawn. So all I've got to spoil is Ray and Susan's kids. I put a lot of thought and energy into spoiling them.
The kaiju burned a stack of Julie's favorite copies of Guns and Ammo, Ray said.
Replaceable, I said. And I'm sure it gave her useful experience in the operation of a fire extinguisher. Besides, baby kaiju are cute.
It was cute, Milo said. Julie was heartbroken when Ray and Susan took it away.
Making us the bad guys, Ray said.
That's what parents are for. Parents are meanies. Uncles are fun. That's why I don't intend to be a parent and love being an uncle. I hope you didn't actually kill it. Not only are those things endangered, they're expensive as hell.
We didn't. You're not the only one with contacts. We got it shipped to a kaiju island.
There are kaiju islands? Decay asked. Where do you think they come from? Milo said.
The life cycle of a kaiju is breed in water, lay eggs on land, I explained. Something like turtles. But instead of returning to the water, the young spend their first century on land. They are omnivorous and cannibalistic, which is why the very young climb trees, to get away from their older siblings. They're also hunted by various other critters. Seagulls will eat a baby kaiju. Very high death rate, and the mature adults are rare and breed very rarely. Only about one kaiju in 10,000 makes it to adulthood.
Then they eat Tokyo, Milo said.
Only found on certain islands near the Japanese coast, Ray added. The Japanese consider them something like gods and protect the islands where they grow. Couple of them aren't even on maps. When they're about 2 centuries old, they go back to the water, where they are still preyed upon by bigger kaiju, great whites, and giant squid. Until they get big enough to eat back. When they get really big,
they eat Tokyo, Milo repeated.
They eat Tokyo, Ray agreed. Almost always those are females looking for a good place to lay eggs. Tokyo Bay used to be one of their main laying grounds, and the Japanese islands used to be a primary growth area. So the Japanese hunters try to drive them back into the water rather than kill them.
And sometimes they lay eggs while stomping all over power lines, which are worth a pretty penny on the black market.
Which are strictly forbidden for trade by the Japanese government, Ray said darkly. As we were reminded.
Which is why they're worth a pretty penny, I shrugged. The little ones are really pretty just before they, you know, blast plasma, Milo said. They get all glowy and blue and red,
which gives you just enough time to jump off a branch that's 20 feet up in the air, Ray said, and sprain your ankle.
Big guys, I said, shrugging again. No agility.
Earl entered the room.
We got a call.
Oh, thank God, Ray replied.
Shamblers in a cemetery.
I've got it. I stood up. You'd think this town would eventually run out of bodies.
I was up on the wall of the cemetery, coaching Norbert in the finer arts of killing shamblers while avoiding being bit, when MCB showed up.
Be aware, before the Revenge of the Crawfish, MCB rarely, if ever, showed up for an incident. Trying to keep a lid on knowledge of hoodoo in New Orleans was like trying to deny the existence of rain in Seattle. But the new crop of agents were serious players from D.C.
They were going to shut down any reference to hoodoo in New Orleans and get this town under control.
Yeah, right.
What the hell do you think you're doing up there?
Agent Larry Rivera yelled. There was a special agent in charge and two senior agents assigned in New Orleans. In addition, they generally had a junior agent shadowing each, as well as a cast of I wasn't sure how many working in the office doing background cover-up. Rivera was the new second senior agent along with Jack Robinson, who I'd met briefly before my vacation. Serious player, with some time in the SRT and that bulky spec ops look. He knew his job and wasn't taking any shit from hunters, by God. I'm shooting zombies. I personally felt that was fairly obvious. You could see the arms waving through the wrought iron gate.
Right up there in front of everybody?
He practically screamed.
You're right off I-10. There are hundreds of people just passing through New Orleans watching you right now. This would be a Class 1 event if it wasn't for your grandstanding. No, it's at least a Class 3.
Aware that the answer is yes, would you prefer we get down on the ground and get bit?
From up here, we're out of reach, and I don't care what your excuse is,
the agent screamed.
Don't do this in plain sight.
Or what? I asked, leaning over and shooting another shambler.
Or I'll place you under arrest.
So now I was in the back of a squad car, minding my own business. Great first day back at work. Earl paid my bail for discharge of a weapon in the city limits. Remy picked me up, bland-faced. I thought about the issue the whole way home. Remy, I said as we walked in the door, could you be so kind as to call Congressman Terry and begin planning a dinner party for 10 guests? Nice one. 4 days after the full moon has passed.
The guest list, sir?
Remy asked. Myself, hostess. I'll need an appropriate hostess. Miss Collins won't do for this. Please inquire with Madam Courtney on that subject. Ask her to ask the Lois. Congressman Randolph and whichever wife he's on. Madam Courtney and gentlemen, Councilman DeLon plus one.
The councilman, sir,
Remy said uncomfortably. Councilman DeLon and Madam Courtney are not friends. My real estate lady was also a powerful hoodoo practitioner. Whiteside. I am aware. Last, Supervisory Special Agent Campbell plus one.
Again. Sir,
you doubt Special Agent Campbell will attend? That is why I need Mr. Terry. Hey, Gary, I said. Garrett, Terry, and I had known each other for a while. 2 years before, while handling a zombie outbreak in a small town in Washington, who should show up but the local congressman? He was from a neighboring town, had gone to school in the town zombies had just wiped out, was just read in on the existence of the supernatural, and was that pissed about everything hoodoo and how it was handled by the government. That was when I'd gotten involved in politics. Not doing politics, working background. I raised campaign finance funds from hunters and funneled them via the congressman and his senior aide, Bert Kemper, to other Congress critters. I'd even testified before the Select Committee on Unearthly Forces a time or two. Surprisingly enough, hunters prior to my involvement had very little voice in the whole thing. I hadn't changed that entirely, but I'd gotten the voice out there. There was still more money going to monster advocacy groups than hunters, even with puff bonuses. But we at least had a voice and some representatives that were on our side for more reasons than the ongoing campaign money. Our lobbyist regularly pointed out that one of the reasons monster advocates were always around to schmooze was that they weren't, you know, out there fighting monsters and saving people. Hey, Chad, Gary said. You never call, you never write. Katie didn't get the babushka doll? I asked, referring to the congressman's daughter. You got any idea how hard it is to convince a 6-year-old not to talk about a magic babushka doll? She can talk about it all she wants. Nobody's gonna believe her. She wanted to take it to school for show and tell. That might cause issues, I replied. Where in the hell did you get that thing? A babushka doll is one of those Russian dolls where you open up the outer doll and there's another smaller one inside. Open that up and there's another. Mostly there's generally 6. Really good ones are up to 10 or 12. The magic babushka had about 60. All the same size instead of increasingly smaller. But in addition, all you had to do was say a magic word, and they all started bouncing around and singing a Ukrainian nursery rhyme about Baba Yaga. Very cool. Much better than a Teddy Ruxpin. I have contacts, like one of the senior aides on the SCUF committee. So you must want something, Gary said. I need an arm twisted. I'm planning a small get-together after the next full moon. Some friends and acquaintances. Congressman Arnold. Seriously? You know I've made contributions. The guy makes Huey Long look honest, Gary said. Which is part of the point. I'll get him for the party. That's not the issue. He'll show up just to keep the money flowing and 'cause I set a good table. With whatever bimbo he's currently married to or shagging. Problem is Campbell. Name doesn't ring a bell. Supervisory Special Agent Campbell. MCB's finest. New boss here in Nolan. Problems? Gary asked. I just got released from NOLA PD custody for discharge of a firearm in city limits. Isn't that sort of your job? The congressman asked, confused. The actual reason was I was standing on a wall potting zombies, and I quote, in full view of everyone. 'Cause I didn't want to get down on the ground and get bit. Which annoyed one of the new guys from MCB here in town. When I refused to comply with his directives, to put myself and my newbie partner in harm's way, he placed me under arrest. Oh. So I'd like to invite Agent Campbell to a friendly party, with the corrupt congressman who is, also, one of the senior Democrat members of the SCUF committee, which decides not only how much funding MCB gets, but who gets promoted and who doesn't. A hoodoon white priestess with more contacts than God, and a NOLA city council member who's a known dark hoodoo dabbler, who is one of the congressman's main supporters. Chad, do you like playing with fire? I could hear the unstated groan. And I was pretty sure he'd start stress eating right after this call. He never ate anything but salads when we'd eaten out, but he kept a drawer full of moon pies in his desk. It's going to be a few days after the full moon. We've partially gotten the loup-garou infestation under control. And by we, I meant Earl. But the full moon still is a major issue every month. I think he'll be sufficiently beaten up by that. He might see some sense. If not, I'll have to up the ante. 'Cause I'm not going to be told to take chances by MCB with our casualty rate. Not going to happen. Are we making lots of money in this town? Yep. Tons. Is it worth the casualty rate? We're on the edge of saying no, Gary. And if MHI isn't here, who's going to control the hoodoo? Some other company? Nobody is as good as we are, and everyone knows it. Look at what happened in Portland. If we can't do it, who can? SIU has already been hammered. You going to permanently install an SRT? Or are you just going to let the hoodoo flow and let local MCB try to handle it? I understand, Gary said. I don't think you do. I don't think anyone does, because there's no one left who has the experience of fighting this shit in this damn city. Day in and day out. I know damn good and well Campbell doesn't. We damn near had a class 5 at Mardi Gras. We came within a big pile of our bodies of having mantis shrimp cracking Brent Musburger's skull right in front of God and everybody.
Yeah, I got the briefing on that. I'm sorry about your friends.
That wasn't our fault, but the first thing Campbell did when he came to town was chew my ass for it. The sole fucking survivor, Garrett. That's who got his ass chewed. The guy who'd held the fucking line and saved not only hundreds of lives, but kept it from turning up on live television. Because I was the only one left to chew their ass. Everyone else, Garrett, was fucking dead with their brains scooped out. So I'll be goddamned if I'm gonna take shit from some no-account, no-experience, no-guts MCB agent who thinks his only job is intimidating people. I fucking quit, Garrett. I quit monster hunting. For 2 weeks, I was done. And if this is what we're gonna be dealing with, I'm damn well not gonna be fighting Hoodoo and MCB. And neither will MHI.
I'd heard you took a vacation. I hadn't gotten the rest of that.
So pull whatever strings you need to pull. Twist whatever arms you need to twist, but Campbell is going to accept an invitation to a dinner party. And by then, maybe he'll be amenable to reason. Maybe he'll realize that this isn't D.C. This isn't St. Louis. This is the city of the dead. And life is short and cheap in this fucking town. Assuming you don't spend eternity as an animated corpse.
Listen, there's other things going on. Can you take a few days?
Garrett asked. I thought about that for a few seconds. As long as I'm back for the full moon.
Why?
Seriously need a sit down. Something's come up. That sounded ominous. I'll call Earl and catch a flight, I said. Chapter 3 I'd arranged with Earl for a couple more days, told him why, and hit the first flight to D.C. Something was rotten in Sodom on Potomac, but that was usually the case. A car met me at the Dulles and headed south into Prince William County. "You sure we're going the right way?" I asked. I hadn't made hotel arrangements, since I could do that in D.C. just as easy. But I generally stayed in town.
"The address I was given is in Manassas, sir," the driver said.
"Odd," I replied. "But let's see where it leads." I'd picked up my checked guns and moved them to more appropriate places in a restroom in the airport. I didn't believe that Garrett Terry would set me up, but that didn't mean someone hadn't. If I was deep in the shit with MCB, strange things might happen. The two-story house in Manassas was in a plain suburb, nothing to distinguish it from a million more in the area. The congressman's aide, Bert Kemper, was outside before the driver could get out to get my bags.
"We need to get inside," he said, looking around nervously.
"You seriously need to get your game on. We weren't followed, unless there's a tracer."
"We just need to get inside," Bert said. "You do. Quick."
Congressman Garrett Terry, a.k.a. Gary, representative of and for the 4th District, Washington State, was waiting in the house. "Gary," I shook his hand. The congressman was tall and rangy, with weathered features from growing up a cowboy. He'd passed the bar and later run for Congress, but he still had that cowboy look.
"Chad," Gary said, "come on in and get situated. We need to talk."
"Sounds like I've been called into the principal's office."
"More like we both have," Gary said, sitting down on the couch. He had a highball of scotch, and it didn't look like his first.
"What's MCB doing now?" I asked.
"Not even sure it's MCB," Gary said, as Bert came in and perched on a chair. "You're under investigation. We got that third hand. Because due to my close relationship with you, so am I."
"Congressional Ethics Panel?"
"Criminal," Bert said. "But we don't even know what charge."
"Oh, it's MCB. It has their fingerprints all over it. As long as it's an ongoing investigation, they can keep up the smear campaign indefinitely. They don't have to charge me with anything. In fact, no charges are better than definite information. People can make up whatever charges they want in their heads. The scarier, the better. That's what we've been saying, Bert said.